Hey, everybody. Welcome to Tectonic. My name is Mark Hurst. I'll be your host for the next hour. Today, as I speak to you, it is February 24, 2025, which is an important anniversary. Now, I know that you might be listening a few days after this, but what I'm going to tell you still applies, which is that it has been 3 years since Russia invaded Ukraine. The invasion started on February 24, 2022. Of course, Russia had invaded eastern Ukraine several years before, and so you could say that this was a continuation of what Russia was already doing. But February 24, 2022 is the day it all changed, because that's when Russia made a full-scale invasion and tried to take over the entire country. And so on this anniversary of war, I think it's appropriate that we talk about the subject a little bit and within the perspective of Tectonic, to talk about how technology is affecting war, and specifically how AI is affecting war and is likely to change it in the future. I don't say this, and I didn't choose this topic for this show as some sort of a booster. If you've listened to the show enough, I think you know me. This is not a gee whiz, look at this cool weapon system sort of conversation. I'm merely trying to report what's happening, because this is something that is active in the world, and you deserve to know about it. And it's also important because the technology used on the battlefield tends to spread to the rest of us. And a good example of that is drones. And drones are a topic that I've talked about a number of times over the years on the show. I remember interviewing the author Arthur Holland Michel a number of years ago about his book Eyes in the Sky, which was about drones. And what I learned in that book, and what Arthur and I spoke about in the interview, is that the drones, the military drones, the police drones that we see in the skies. I mean, not too long ago, we're in the skies here in New Jersey. Those all started as a military technology, as the U.S. military was floating drones over the battlefield in Iraq and surveilling the people and the circumstances, the events, the actions on the ground in the towns where the Americans were. And when there was an IED, an improvised explosive device that went off, they were able to look at the footage from the drone and basically play it backwards, play the surveillance footage backwards to see who had planted the bomb and where they came from. Anyway, that's all covered in Eyes in the Sky. But the point is that drones that seem to be ever present on battlefields today, and over some cities today, all started from the Iraq battlefield. And so if we look at what's happening today in the conflict in Ukraine, we can see that technology has advanced quite a bit from past conflicts, and there are clues as to where technology is going to be headed in the future. Again, both for war, but also for how governments are going to deploy those technologies against citizens here and in other countries. And so I think it's well worth taking a look at this. A few days ago, downstairs in Monty Hall here at WFMU in Jersey City, I hosted a movie night to watch a new documentary. It's directed by Daniel Wunderer, or if you want to use the the Austrian pronunciation or the German pronunciation. It's Wunderer. Daniel is based in Vienna, Austria, and the film is called Flash Wars: Autonomous Weapons, AI, and the Future of Warfare. After the screening a few nights ago, I was happy to speak with Daniel via Zoom. It was right after the film ended, so it was 9:30 p.m. my time here in New Jersey, and his time in Vienna, it was 3:30 a.m. the next morning. So it was nice of Daniel to stay up. In a moment, I'm going to play you that conversation. But first, I want to give you a little bit of context about this film in case you haven't seen it. And by the way, if you want a link to Daniel's site, the trailer of the film, which I'll also play the audio for you, and a link to a distributor here in the U.S. for the film, it's all on the playlist. If you go to tectonic.fm, tectonic.fm, and just find the AI and the Future of Warfare episode, click the playlist link, and you'll see all of those links there. This movie, Flash Wars, covers, as the subtitle says, autonomous weapons, AI, and the future of warfare. And what that means in detail is that it's covering drones, it's covering robots, and it's covering the platforms of AI that use data and algorithms in order to carry out all the operations, the surveillance, the targeting, the deployment of the munitions. And so the film interviews a number of people on different in different roles. There are a number of people who are at defense contractors, these companies that are making these weapon systems. Obviously, they're very excited about the capabilities of these systems. We hear from soldiers and officers who have been in battle zones where those today's versions of those technologies have been deployed and what they think of the future of warfare. And in the middle of it, there is this researcher from McGill University in Montreal, this woman, Ajung Moon, who you're going to hear about, I mention in my conversation with Daniel. And Moon is advocating for regulation of autonomous weapon systems and has spoken at the United Nations, where there have been efforts for years to try to rein in the spread of these things. And it's really important because the spread of technology is hitting on a lot of different angles right now. But one of them is this idea of autonomous weapons. So if you think about a drone has a camera, let's say, and it has, maybe there's a bomb strapped to the drone. And so maybe it's a suicide drone. It's going to drop down on a target. Well, many or perhaps most of the drones right now in the air, and probably most of them being used in conflict right now, are on the battlefield in Ukraine. They're what's called FPV, first-person view drones. Basically, a human operator will put on something like a virtual reality headset so that they can see what the drone sees, and they control the drone, and they look through the camera, they find where the target is, where they think it is, and then they direct the drone to fall down onto that target. Maybe it's a tank or an enemy encampment or something. And so because there is a connection between the human operator and the drone in the air, the countermeasure for this, for the forces on the other side, is jamming. They try to jam the frequencies, jam the data connection between the operator and the drone, and their variety of countermeasures. And so there's a cat and mouse game going on about jamming and trying to evade jamming. As Daniel will bring up in the conversation, now there are drones that are actually connected via a very thin fiber optic cable. So it's not a wireless connection. It's actually wired as the drone is flying. Those cannot be jammed. But the future of warfare is autonomous drones. And those evade jamming completely because the drone, when it's in the air, no longer is connected to a human operator. Using machine learning algorithms, it identifies its target automatically and drops down and blows up that target by itself without any human operator giving those instructions. And that's really chilling, because if you think about the AI systems that we have talked about on this show, for example, facial recognition. We've talked about the error rate in facial recognition. And if you think about, and this is a possibility that is floated in Flash Wars explicitly, think about a future generation of drones that are autonomous and are connected to a facial recognition algorithm. So if they're floating around and identify someone who, according to their own AI internal logic, the drone believes it needs to attack that person, there's no human in the loop. And so a lot of what Flash Wars is talking about is the future of warfare becoming more automated, more digital, with fewer humans in the loop, with less decision power in the moment, and militaries and governments putting their faith and trust in these fully autonomous AI-driven weapon systems to fight their wars for them. And again, if you have been following the development of AI systems in non-war contexts in the last year or two, that should make you very worried. Because there is no sense that these AI systems are going to be perfected before they're loaded up in an autonomous drone and then floated over combatants and or civilian populations. There was one counter to Professor Moon at McGill. There was one interviewee at Johns Hopkins at APL, the Applied Physics Lab. And this woman said, from Johns Hopkins at one point, I'm not going to get the quote exactly right, but she said basically, we need to move fast and accept greater risks. So if you're worried about accuracy and AI, get over it, because she didn't put it this way, but this is how I interpreted it. You need to get over your hesitation over AI, because this is coming and we need to develop it even faster than China does. That was a lot of the movie was U.S. boosters saying we have to catch up with China. We have to beat China, as though that's our mandate now, to put AI into everything on the battlefield. So a lot to take in, a lot to worry about, plenty of nightmare fuel. I think what I'd like to do now is I'd like to play you this interview. First, what we're going to hear is we're going to hear the trailer for Flash Wars, and then we're going to hear my conversation with Daniel Wunderer. Again, the documentary is called Flash Wars, Autonomous Weapons, AI, and the Future of Warfare, and it was recorded a few nights ago at the screening. Let's go ahead and listen to that now on Tectonic.
March the 12th, 2022. It's day 17 of the Ukraine war. A drone goes down between two rows of houses. With a wingspan of just over 1 meter and bearing no visible weapon systems, it appears inconspicuous. Its crash is almost lost in the horror of the Russian invasion. And yet, it is of great significance. That's because it is a Kube BLA, a suicide drone that can be controlled by artificial intelligence. circles autonomously above the target area, ready to swoop down at the right moment. It is the harbinger of a technological quantum leap that will change war forever.
First of all, everybody, let's show our appreciation to Daniel for staying up until 3:30 in the morning local time. Thank you, Daniel.
You're welcome. Thank you for the invitation.
We all really enjoyed Flash Wars. Excellent work on that.
Thank you so much.
And I have many comments I could make about the film. I thought you did a brilliant job of bringing in so many different voices, talking about AI, autonomous weapons, the future of warfare, cognitive warfare. There's so many policing. There's so many different threads you're able to work in. My favorite story in the whole film, the German soldier who had been in Iraq and Afghanistan and other areas, and he gave the example of the Taliban in Afghanistan. And he said, yes, the U.S. came in with superior firepower and technology, and we had drones, and we were untouchable. And look where it ended up after so many thousands of both Allied forces and Afghans were killed in that terrible conflict. We're back to 2001. The Taliban are back in charge. And he said that it looks like, or maybe this was the narrator, digital technology was able to create peace, or not peace, but project power on behalf of the U.S. temporarily. But in the long run, the conflict came back to that fundamental of whether the citizens trusted the occupying force. And so in the end, the supposed power of the digital technology was neutralized. At the same time, you have Eric Schmidt, the former chairman of Google, a clip of him selling his AI weaponry, saying, oh, we have to catch up with the Chinese. So my question for you is, what is your point of view? Do you think we need to believe the Eric Schmidts of the world, that this stuff, we have to get on board and we have to invest in this? Or do you take the German soldier's statement and say, actually, in the long run, it's not a great idea to invest in this?
Well, the problem is a little bit the genie is out of the bottle. I don't know if you cannot invest in that, given the climate, the political climate at the moment. You know, it seems to be like nobody really wants it, but nobody wants to leave it to the others. And that's a bit of the problem. If I could choose, I would say, let's not do this. But I'm not sure if that is really in the cards at the moment. And we have rising conflicts all over the world. And I mean, now you also have a new president who is definitely wants to be project power. And we have Putin, we have the Chinese who want to project power. Now we have the problem that Europe as well will have to think about how to deal with the fact that the Americans just told us, basically, you are alone. So now also the Europeans will have to invest in more defense. And as countries that don't really have a military culture, and I think you also heard in the film that there is not a lot of people who want to go into the army, in especially the German-speaking countries. So what are we going to do? Are we going to build robots? Are we going to leave it to the AI? I don't know. You know, I don't have those answers, but it's certainly a possibility. The issue is that we saw that in Afghanistan. You can win wars with drones, but you cannot make lasting peace. And war is, if you see it as an extreme measure of communication, the end game is always to get to peace, you know, otherwise you have everlasting war. And I don't think AI can create, or robots can make peace, you know, just humans can make peace. If I look a person in the eye, maybe there is an option to say, okay, I don't want to die, you don't want to die, let's work this out in a way, you know. Of course, I'm making it a bit easier than it really is, but in the end, you can only make peace if you look your enemy in the eye, I think. And we're not going to make that with robots. We're not going to have that with robots.
And that was, I felt like, one of the main messages that who I felt the hero of the film was Moon at McGill University. She talks, I really appreciated that you included her backstory. She wanted to be the CEO of a robotics company growing up, and then she got to the point where she realized she had the education and the skills to build a robot that could police the DMZ with sensors and guns and so on, and she decided to take a different path. And she seemed to make the point again and again, we as humans have the responsibility to be stewards. We can draw on technology, we can deploy it, but it's up to us to make the right decision because the machines are only going to follow the script that they've been given. And yet, again, it seems like her message, which I completely agree with, is up against such enormous forces of money and power and influence that want to push things the other way and have the entire world bristling with lethal autonomous weapons systems. What do you think if we asked Professor Moon what she thought the future would be? I mean, you talked to her. Is she optimistic about where the world is headed, or is she going ahead and building a bunker somewhere near Montreal?
No, she's not building a bunker. I think hope always prevails a little bit, but I wouldn't say she's looking into the future very positively. But I also have to say that me, while working on the film, I met a lot of roboticists who were aware of her opinion. I think more people are of her opinion, and most people want to use robotics for good, and there is a lot of good that can be done with this technology. The thing is, you don't need that many people to use them for other things, you know, and robots are a tool. AI at the moment is still a tool. It doesn't have consciousness yet. Well, let's hope that will not come too quickly. So at the moment, it's still up to us. And there is a lot of good people who are working in these fields. And at the moment, we have the problem that the people who are making the top-down decisions, and Arjun said, like, we need the bottom up and we need the top down. At the moment, the top down people seem to be not the best people. Maybe the bottom up approach is the better one, but one can feel a little bit powerless when the powerful make the decisions against our best judgment, I would say. And it should be their best judgment, but
one would think
obviously they are not doing it.
Well, I'm glad to hear that you came across many roboticists who are working
yes.
for good. You got a great view onto the robotics community. I wonder if our audience has any questions for Daniel on this wonderful documentary. Question is, from the inception of the film to delivering the final cut, how long did it take to make this movie?
2 years, more or less. Maybe from the inception, even two and a half. Because at the beginning, the big trouble was finding the money. We had a German and a German-French TV channel that does a lot of good documentaries. It's called Arte, which was one of our first backers. And believe it or not, but in 2020, I think it was, we went to them and they said, like, oh, we just had COVID, we have global warming, nobody wants to talk about war. And this is Europe, in especially in Germany or in the German-speaking world. War is not even, we don't talk about this because we have our history, you know?
Right.
We didn't used to, and now, 4 years later, everything has changed.
That's right, sadly.
Sadly, yes.
Another thread that I noticed was the idea of change. Here you're talking about changing attitudes or changing awareness of war, in German-speaking countries, but if we extend that idea of change to everything else you covered in Flash Wars, this is something that came up with a number of your interviewees. They're saying the rate of change is just staggering, that these weapon systems, these AI platforms, are changing so rapidly. I wondered how that impacted your design and planning of the film. Did you find that you had to revision some parts of the film because the technology was changing right under your feet as you were making it?
Certainly, at the beginning, it was more of a film about, something's coming. And then when we started filming, it was suddenly already here. So that changed also the mode of telling the whole story. Then the leaps were not that big, but we tried to stay always on top of it, basically. But now that I think the film was finished in October 2023, and most of it holds up still. Of course, there have been some new developments, but it's not like also in Ukraine, like AI is not everywhere yet. The fact that most drones are still remote controlled is still the case. But we do see that drones are everywhere. And basically, in theory, it's just an update away that you have. Because once you have the hardware on the battlefields, then it's just a software update, you know. Hasn't happened yet, fingers crossed. But I also have to say that what I see, I'm still in Markus Reisner, which is the colonel's Telegram group. And what I see from the battlefield of Ukraine every day with the drones, even without AI, what people are doing to each other, I don't know if it can get any worse, even with AI. You can't hide anywhere. Everything is covered with small drones.
That's what I've read in the news reports. It's dangerous for anybody or any vehicle, and even ambulances will be targeted by the Russians if they can be spotted. It just sounds terrible. What percentage of the drones right now do you think are fully autonomous?
I don't know if there is a lot. There's, from what I know, but I don't have all the inside knowledge at the moment. And there is not much drones that are fully autonomous. Most of them are FPV drones. They are remote controlled with the first person view. The problem is the jamming, especially in the last part, because there's jammers on every vehicle, or they have backpacks with jammers. So you pre-program a target or a target area, which we also saw, I think, in the film. So there is not a lot of evidence that there are fully autonomous drones in the battlefield. It's getting more. They are working on it, but they are working on all sort of things. The Russians, for example, are now using small drones with long cables, which, right, I thought it's ridiculous, but it's fiber, glass fiber, you call, yes, it, I think. Yeah, and they are hundreds of meters long, and they cannot be jammed.
That's
so the,
right,
jamming is the main issue. And I know that the US is working on on jets and a lot of autonomous capabilities, but at the moment we don't see that on the battlefield too much.
Now the documentary is called Flash Wars, and I was waiting and waiting as we watch, when are we going to hear about Flash Wars? And you saved, I guess we could say, Daniel, you saved the worst for last.
Yes.
The most depressing prospect of all is the last scene or two of the documentary, when you finally reveal what Flash Wars are, or what they could be. Hope they never are. Well, maybe you can describe in your own language, if you want to give away the spoiler for people who haven't seen it yet, what are Flash Wars? And seeing that, I wanted to ask the follow-up, what's the chance that we're going to see something like that light up?
So Flash Wars, for those people who haven't seen the film, that's at the moment, thankfully, a theoretical concept where in a future where we have a lot of autonomous weapons on all sides of a conflict. Very autonomous weapons could react to each other and quicker than any human could react, trigger a conflict that nobody wanted. So, I don't know, one side launches, it doesn't even have to be nuclear, one side launches their weapon systems automatically, the other side reacts. And we have seen this in the stock market, where flash crashes occur. When something happens that is out of the ordinary, all the algorithms follow in a herd motion the other algorithms, and then very quickly, before the human can react, crashes happen. But usually they also bounce back very quickly. Thankfully, we are, I think, still far away from that scenario. Why are these scenarios so important anyways to think about it? Because there is, at the moment, very little consensus on what to do. I mean, between the nations, for example. So we need horror scenarios like that, that say, okay, the Chinese don't want to lose control, the Americans don't want to lose control. Nobody wants this, you know. Can we at least agree on that and early enough start working together? Because these are the like, let's say, climate change, these are the global problems that we can only solve if everybody works together. If one nation or one big nation, I mean, Austria cannot make that big of a difference, but the US could make a big difference. If one of those nations says, no, we want these weapons, then of course the other nations will do the same. So it is very important that we have these scenarios like flash wars that could potentially happen, but I'm not saying they are going to happen in 5 years or something like that. To pull people together, I think that's what ideas like that are for. Because maybe one more thing, I mean, that was the thing with nuclear weapons. We never had our, in the 80s, people were afraid of nuclear war, but it never happened. Exactly because we knew that if this starts, then we are all screwed. And it's a bit the same with AI. If you only think very small, then you say, okay, a little bit there, a little bit there. If not enough, if it's not a world-ending thing, then people will use it.
And that's why I think that final act of Flash Wars is so important. You're pointing the camera on what could happen, what the risks are, what the stakes are in this global investment in this new technology. And so I think you're doing us a service by issuing a warning while giving all sides a chance to speak their piece. I'll just say I'm on Professor Moon's side, but everyone has to choose.
I think,
their team.
I think I'm also on her side. The thing is, sometimes it's not up to us, but maybe a little bit is up to us. I hope that, you know, we can influence other people. And at the end of the day, we still live in a democracy, hopefully for the next decades.
Well, I'll have to get back to you on that here in the U.S.
Yeah.
Daniel, this is a great film. What should people do when they tell their friends, you got to watch this film? How can people mobilize to get more people to see your work?
I think this one in the U.S. You can get through Video Project. I think that's also where you booked the film. There is also some platforms in Canada. And in Europe, it's quite easy because it's on the public channels on YouTube. But there is a geo-blocking. Or you can always drop me an email and we'll find a way.
What email should people use if they want to contact you?
Oh, just use daniel.a.wunderer. That's WUNDRNDR at gmail.com.
Great. Well, Daniel, I really appreciate, again, you staying up so late or perhaps getting up very early there in Vienna, Austria. How about a round of applause for Daniel?
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Daniel.
And thank you for watching the film. And thank you for the invitation. And I think I'm going to go to sleep now.
Okay. It was really a privilege to talk to you. Thank you so much again. Have a good night.
Best of luck.
Okay. Thank you. And we're back. If you are just tuning in, you are listening to Tectonic. My name is Mark Hurst. I'll be your host for the remaining 20-ish minutes of the show. We just heard my interview with Daniel Wunderer, director of the new documentary Flash Wars, Autonomous Weapons, AI, and the Future of Warfare. You can get links to the film and Daniel's site and some other things if you go to the playlist for today's show, which is at tectonic.fm, tectonic.fm. Find the Autonomous Weapons and AI show and click the playlist link, and it's right there. I hope you got a good sense of the documentary from the conversation. Oh, and by the way, in case you want to reach Daniel, his email address is also on the playlist. And if the spelling didn't come out, it's daniel.a.wunderer@gmail.com. Wunderer is the last name. I hope you that, as I said, I hope you found some helpful information in that Q&A after the documentary. And in particular, there is an invitation that came up in my conversation with Daniel and is present in the film as well, which is that we could use some help. And I'm saying we as humanity. We could use some help working on banning or at least regulating lethal autonomous weapons systems. That's often communicated with the acronym LAWS, L-A-W-S. And as I said, Ajun Moon in Montreal is working on this. There's other people, there are groups and organizations who've been working on this for a long time. Humanity needs some help because this technology is coming. It's being funded by the most powerful and wealthiest companies in the world economy, and it is being pushed ahead by the major governments as well. And there is no regulation in sight. There are no guardrails on this. The spread of AI, inaccuracy and all, is everywhere. And we're rushing headlong into a future where the battlefield of the future are dominated by these AI systems. And then, as I said at the top of the show, these AI systems come back to civilian life and affect all of our lives in other ways. So it would be so much better if we tried to put some guardrails, some restrictions, some common sense around these technologies now before they totally run amok. And as for the name Flash Wars, I think you heard in that last long answer that Daniel gave, it's the name of the movie comes from the idea of the flash crash, which has happened a couple of times on Wall Street, where these automated systems all react to one another much faster than humans can react. And all of a sudden, you've got this huge crash in the market. And that's one thing if it's localized to stock market. But when you have two major militaries that have lethal autonomous weapon systems that start to react to one another's algorithms, that can be a runaway cascade effect that we do not want to be a part of. And I think Daniel was right to compare it to the threat of nuclear war that was so ever present in the 1980s. I remember growing up with that. And so we've got to add to our nightmare fuel this idea of flash wars with runaway AI systems. Again, another reason for someone out there or some people out there to stand up and start investing their time and energy on regulating this. Here in the New York area, New York, New Jersey area, there was an incident recently, a couple of years ago, where the New York Police Department acquired some robo dogs from a company called Boston Dynamics. I covered this on the show. And in fact, the NYPD robo dogs, which I think were given the cutesy little name of Spot. Why? Oh, Spot would never harm anybody. The robo dogs appeared in the documentary as well, Flash Wars. And there was a real urgent and strong pushback, an immediate pushback from the citizens of the neighborhoods in Manhattan where the NYPD was running these robo-dogs down the street. And the NYPD pulled it. I mean, our mayor, Eric Adams, never met a technology he didn't like. And he was really excited that he could have robot dogs running around. And the citizens said, no way. And so it can work if citizens rise up and say no to these things. And maybe in the end, I mean, what we'd really like to get to is that the budgets that were going to these robots would be deployed in ways that actually would help the communities in significant ways. There was an incident about, I guess, 10 or 15 years ago where there was this terrible incident in Dallas where a sniper was shooting cops from a building, and the Dallas Police Department put a bomb on a robot and ran the robot into where the sniper was hiding and blew him up. This incident was the incident came up briefly in this documentary, Flash Wars, and it also came up in a documentary a few years ago called The Truth About Killer Robots. I had the director of that on as well, Maxim Pozderevsky. This back in the archives if you want to listen to it. And I remember in that documentary, there was a brief interview with one of the police from the Dallas Police Department. And he said in the aftermath of that incident, the chief of police said that he wanted to buy more robots. And he said, that's the wrong way for us to do policing. Essentially, that's not a direct quote, but essentially he was saying, we don't need more robots in policing. We need police to form better relationships with the community. And that's where the budget should go. And yet, what leaders everywhere seem to be reaching for these days is more robots. And when we look at the militarization of police departments, I think we're going to be seeing more drones, because that's what's coming off of the battlefields, more AI systems. And that's the wrong direction for us. That's the wrong direction. And this documentary, Flash Wars, is a great warning for where we're headed. And so go take a look at the playlist at tectonic.fm. See the film if you can. And try to, if this moves you, try to get involved in creating a better future for us than the one that we're on right now, thanks to Eric Schmidt and the various governments that are putting in these giant orders for untested AI systems, largely untested. The last thing I want to talk about before we close is I want to say something again about this 3-year anniversary. As I said at the beginning of the show, I'm recording this on February 24, or I'm speaking on February 24, 2025, which is the 3-year anniversary of Russia's invasion into Ukraine. And on the playlist, I've put some resources talking about the significance of this day. There are two posts. There is actually one New York Times piece, and there's one Macedon piece from members of the Ukrainian military. The one in the Times is by Artem Chek, who's a novelist and a sergeant in the Ukrainian army, who writes a piece called "This Is Our Country and We Have No Other," and he talks about he responds to the difficulty that our current occupant of the White House has in saying who started this war 3 years ago. And what he writes is, quote, "The truth is too obvious. The whole world knows who started this war. It's not entirely clear whom the current occupant is speaking to, but he's not speaking to Ukrainians. All we can do is fight on and defend our right to exist. And he goes on, and there's photos in the piece. I put a GIF link on the playlist, so even if you don't have a Times account, you can get through the paywall and check out that story. It's well worth reading what Mr. Cech has written. It is beyond frustrating to see what is happening in this country, where the current occupant of the White House is unable to speak the truth about who started the war and what the next step should be for the Ukrainians, who are fighting for their survival. This is their democracy, their country is on the line, and they have no choice but to fight back. And thank goodness for the drones. I mean, to bring it back to the technology, there is a burgeoning drone industry in Ukraine. And as I spoke in a recent interview, which I'll tell you about in a second, it is somewhat decisive, the power of the drones from the Ukrainian side in holding off the Russian onslaught as much as they have for the past 3 years. So in this case, the drones are a very welcome technology because Ukraine has needed this to survive. I spoke a few months ago with Yaroslav Trofimov, who's the author of a book called Our Enemies Will Vanish, talking about the war in Ukraine. I want to play you a brief excerpt of this, where he's talking about the importance of drones to the Ukrainian war effort. Here's what he said.
Both sides use it. And it's very efficient against Russian T-80 and T-72s, but it's also very efficient against American-made Abrams tanks. And that's a revolution. You have naval drones. You know, Ukraine has developed, and it doesn't have a navy, really, but it has developed a naval drone industry in which its naval drones can hit ports in Crimea and Russia and have really crippled the much more expensive Russian navy in the Black Sea. You have the reconnaissance drones that both sides are using to great effect, that are flying over enemy territory and are guiding missile strikes, dozens, sometimes more than 100 miles away. And then what Ukraine has really developed in the past year and a half is this long-range drones that can go more than 1,000 miles, including the new ones that are reactive drones, so they have propulsion engines that kind of blur the line between drone and missile, really. What is a drone and what's a cruise missile?
Right.
How do you find the boundary? And these have been used to strike military targets like ammunition depots, airfields, far, far away in Russia. So it's a critical element of Ukraine's way of waging the war, but also Russia's.
Yeah. Just to give listeners a sense of the scale of these drone operations, you write that, quote, all over the Ukrainian front lines, hundreds, if not thousands, of these commercial drones were in the air at any given time during daylight hours, augmented by fleets of more sophisticated DJI commercial quadcopters and winged drones manufactured specifically for the military.
And that was early in the war. That was in the very early days, when the Ukrainians and the Russians relied mostly on, as you say, Chinese-made DJI drones that were souped up and used for reconnaissance. That was before the FPV revolution. FPV is the first-person view drones. And now there are thousands of them being flown at all times. They're so cheap that, I mean, just imagine the calculation. You know, one single artillery shell, a 155 millimeter, costs about, let's say, $3,000 to $5,000. And then these are not precision weapons. You need to fire several of them, maybe a dozen, to hit a target. One FPV drone at $300 can do that. You know, there are roads that are now basically impassable and within 20 miles of the front line on both sides because any moving vehicle just gets hit by those FPV drones.
Okay, and again, that was an excerpt of my October 14, 2024 interview with Yaroslav Trofimov, author of Our Enemies Will Vanish, a book about the war in Ukraine. You can find that in the archives at tectonic.fm, T-E-C-H, tonic.fm. The last thing I want to read for you is a brief excerpt of a piece by Francis Fukuyama, who is probably still best known for his 1992 book, The End of History. But I thought that he, on February 20, he had a great perspective about the U.S.'s 180 on our relationship with our ally, who should be our ally, who we have been supporting and we should continue to be supporting. Fukuyama wrote a piece called The Ultimate Betrayal, and here's a part of it. Quote, "We are in the midst of a global fight between Western liberal democracy and authoritarian government. And in this fight, the United States has just switched sides and signed up with the authoritarian camp. What the current occupant has said over the past few days about Ukraine and Russia defies belief. He has accused Ukraine of having started the war by not preemptively surrendering to Russian territorial demands. He has said that Ukraine is not a democracy. And he has said that Ukrainians were wrong to resist Russian aggression. These ideas are likely not ones he thought up himself, but come straight from the mouth of Vladimir Putin, a man the current occupant has shown great admiration for." And later he writes, "The United States, under this current occupant of the White House, is not retreating into isolationism. It is actively joining the authoritarian camp." And I thought that was well stated. So friends, if you think about it, we're hurtling into a future where militaries are investing in these autonomous weapon systems powered by AI that's not fully tested, and we're being led by a current occupant of the White House who is actively abandoning our allies and joining up with the authoritarian camp. It is beyond words what is happening in this country. And all I can hope is that we will get back on the right track and start acting like Americans again someday. Next week, I'm going to be back on the show as we start our fundraising marathon here at WFMU. My co-host will be station manager Ken Friedman. I'm looking forward to that. I know this evening was a little bit of a bummer, kind of a down show, but I really feel like it's important for you to know the truth of what is happening in technology and how it is going to affect us and how it relates to larger matters. So I hope you find this valuable. You are listening to the greatest radio station in the world, WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope in New York City and Rockland County at 91.9 FM and online at WFMU.org. I want you to stay tuned for Dave Mandel, who's coming up in just a couple of minutes. I do have some homework for you for next time, friends. I want you to avoid Apple, abandon Amazon, forget Facebook, and whatever you do, friends, get off Google. Have a good week, and I'll see you next time.
Yes, that sweet sound means it's time for another installment of It's Complicated, an hour, 60 minutes of Prague and Prague-adjacent music. I'm your host, Dave Mandel. I'm here every Monday, that's now, at this time, 7 p.m. Eastern Time. Thanks so much for joining me. Pleasure to be here, always. And we're going to start this evening's show with another tribute. It just so happens there have been a few of these recently, deaths, landmark birthdays. This, sadly, is a death, and it's one that has to be acknowledged, and that is Jamie Muir. Jamie Muir was the percussionist in King Crimson during their 1972, 73, 74 period, which many people consider one of the greatest bands ever to play music. And King Crimson had been reformed with a completely new lineup at that time, 1972, with the amazing lineup of Bill Bruford on drums and John Wetton on bass, of course Robert Fripp, and Jamie Muir on percussion. And adding Jamie Muir to the band was a major change, I would say, in the King Crimson sound. He was a percussionist. He came from more or less the free improv world, jazz and free improvisation world, and it was kind of a brilliant move to place him in King Crimson. And he only played on one album, which was Lark's Tongues in Aspic, what many people think, possibly me, think was their greatest album, and an incredibly, incredibly influential record. Anyway, so Muir is all over this album, and furthermore, even though he played only on this one, he influenced Bill Bruford, who was already a fantastic, you know, one of the best drummers around, influenced Bruford's playing so that on subsequent albums there was all this crazy percussion that Bill Bruford played that had been inspired by Jamie Muir. So he left a mark, let's put it that way, on Crimson with his percussion. Just really a brilliant guy. And so I'm going to play a track from that album, Lark's Tongues in Aspic. And everyone plays, and rightly so, everyone plays the opening track of the album, Lark's Tongues in Aspic, Part 1. Just an incredible piece of music that opens with a bunch of percussion, but I'm not going to play that because everyone plays it. I'm going to play something different. I'm going to play the track Easy Money, which also features a lot of Jamie Muir, a lot of percussion on it. You'll hear all kinds of weird, almost like comical percussion-y sounds throughout this track. So anyway, King Crimson, Easy Money from the album Lark's Tongues in Aspic, featuring Jamie Muir on percussion.
Could never tell a winner from a snake.